irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, welcome to the show. My name's Allison Garrido, and I'm guest hosting today for Jennifer Hill, who's traveling. I'm thrilled to be here today, and I'm extra happy that I have a close friend of mine, Lori Firestone Seidelman, joining me. Lori's a performance coach, facilitator, and speaker with more than 15 years of experience leading individuals, teams, and organizations to achieve high-impact results. Lori uses core strengths and strategic communication to build creative solutions for a wide range of career and leadership development challenges. Lori and I first met at the Association for Talent Development, and she and I are both instructors for Career U. You may have heard Larry Brayman on Jennifer's show a few months back, and Lori and I have both had the honor of hosting webinars for Larry as well, and those can be found at mycareeru.com. Thank you so much for being here today, Lori.
Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to join you.
It's my absolute pleasure to have you. So our topic for today is really articulating your value in the workplace, and that's something you've done a lot of work around.
It is. You know, I find that in the work I've done with clients, people rely so heavily on job titles and job descriptions to really define themselves that in the sea of overpopulated job applicants, mm-hmm. it's really difficult for people to be able to distinguish themselves from one another. So I spend a lot of time helping people understand what makes them unique.
Yeah, I see that a lot, too. There's so many people looking for jobs, and there's so many people thinking, how do I make myself stand out? It feels like I can't even get someone to respond to my resume. I send all these resumes out there, and no one will get back. How do I differentiate myself? This is such important work.
I think so, too. And I think people spend a lot of vacant time in job searches where they're blanket applying in a very reactive way to things that get posted on the internet. And they spend a lot of time kind of what I say shooting all over themselves, so forgive the expression, really passing a lot of judgment on the things that they believe they might have done better if they had only done something previously. And by switching that lens from I need to apply to this because someone told me it would be good, and turning internally to what is it that really makes me tick and I'm already great at, really empowers people to have a better self-esteem when approaching that really vulnerable place that we all have when we're looking for a job.
Absolutely. It can be hard to identify what you're good at. And then once you identify it, it's so empowering because then you can start to talk about it.
Well, yeah. And more importantly, besides us talking about it, other people can talk about it on our behalves. And that's ultimately where most of the jobs are found. They're not found by combing the internet and clicking on applicant tracking systems and submitting. They're found when people are actively out there talking about how we're the best person for the job because we have a particular set of skills that only we can fulfill.
Absolutely. So is this a skill that's particularly important just for people that are looking for their next job, people that are in between jobs? Who can this help?
You know, to be honest, I think it's an important skill for anybody to have for a variety of reasons. More and more companies are looking for what we define as softer skills. Mm-hmm. So you'll hear scholars refer to this as social and emotional competence. You hear sometimes people call it emotional intelligence. And in essence, they're looking for people who have a great understanding of themselves. And as a result, the more people can do work in finding out through the people who know them best what it is they're good at, the greater they can be recognized in their existing jobs, whether they're looking for a position or not, the better they can go home at the end of the day feeling a sense of accomplishment because they're working on the things that are aligned with their natural strengths. Mm-hmm. And in the event that they are going to be looking down the road, the better that people will already be sponsoring their message about how great they are because it's a known commodity out there in the workplace already.
Yeah, so personal branding is really important in all aspects of our careers, whether we're transitioning or staying put. It really impacts all parts of our lives.
It does. And, you know, organizations spend millions of dollars a year on making sure that their brands are solidified. And it doesn't take necessarily a complicated sort of message. I mean, look at Disney as sort of the penultimate, right? You've got these three black circles that demonstrate a mouse head, and suddenly people see that and immediately think of the happiest place on earth. So it doesn't necessarily have to be this incredibly lengthy description of what it is that we do. There's a consistent message around people can expect something from you over and over again. And it helps people identify, again, what it is they're good at and why it is somebody should hire them.
Yeah, so personal branding, like you said, is a lot about consistency. How do you express your personal brand to someone on the first visit or the first time you meet them when you don't have that consistency already there?
Well, that's where I think it becomes really helpful to consistently look for opportunities for people to reflect back to you what it is that you're doing well. Consistency is, it builds trust. And so when people do know you, they come to rely upon you for delivering a similar behavior or a similar service, similar skill set over and over again. As you become more familiar with that because they're repeat customers, so to speak, you are better able to identify those things for people who don't know you well. And then you don't have to lead off with, again, a job title or the company that you work for, because you'll have a sense of confidence about the things that people seek you out for.
Okay. So if I have this consistent message with people who I'm seeing regularly, how do I find out what that message is? I know what I control, but sometimes there's a gap between, I think, the way that people behave and the way that other people see them. So how do we bridge that gap, or how do I make sure that I'm really fostering an image that I want to portray, or making sure I'm correcting if there's something out there that isn't desirable for me?
We actually just touched upon a few things. So the first piece that I think is important is recognizing what image is it that you're wanting people to perceive. So the first part always is to reflect inward and think about, what is it that I want to be known for? And then you might adopt a practice that businesses use all the time called a SWOT analysis. So not SWOT like police officer SWOT, but S-W-O-T. So the S stands for strengths. What is it that I'm naturally good at that I could do blindfolded that comes really easily to me? And the W stands for weaknesses. What is it that I struggle with? What areas constantly go on my development list? The O stands for opportunities. So when thinking about the things that I might want to do next, what's happening in that industry or field? Is there a merger going on, for example, where they might be looking for something with a particular skill set? And then the T, which we often sometimes overlook, is, are there threats? So for example, have I been in a field for a long time and there might be more youthful talent that has different computer skill sets that I was raised with? Or do I not have a foreign language and perhaps my industry is moving more global? So if we can undergo kind of our own SWOT analysis in relation to any kind of target job that we want, we have a better sense of how we might measure up against others. Then the second piece of that is, okay, so now I've got this self-awareness of what it is I want to do and how I might measure up. Then we have to seek outward into our networks and ask others to define for us how they perceive us, because otherwise we have blind spots, and we all have them, where we have either an overinflated sense of our abilities in one area, or more often than not, an undervaluing of something we're naturally good at that we don't see for whatever reason. So asking others, and it doesn't have to be some formal performance review necessarily. In fact, sometimes people closer in our network than our managers and supervisors are the ones that can best help us define those blind spots for ourselves. And then you look at kind of, is there a gap that I need to bridge based on what I see in myself and where I want others to see me, and perhaps the messaging that I'm getting back. And that's where you can empower yourself when you're looking for a job to create some kind of action plan that's purposeful. Because the last thing any of us want to do when we're looking for a job is to give up the things that we can control and play a game of waiting where our fate lies in somebody else's hands. That's a horrible experience.
Absolutely. It can make you feel so vulnerable.
That's it.
So you mentioned performance reviews, right? A 360-degree performance review is a great tool. So people might have those at their fingertips to look at what how they're being perceived and what their personal brand is. If you don't have that, and you're going to reach out to people that are maybe a little closer to you, as you mentioned, should you ask if they'll do a SWOT analysis for you? Should you give them those guidelines?
You know, I actually think the SWOT is probably best served when people are... I reserve the SWOT analysis for my own person.
Okay.
Because I think it's so closely aligned with what it is that I might want to be doing next. Mm-hmm. And for my network, and it also puts a lot of pressure on someone when it's an established template mm-hmm. and form, because what if they're not familiar with it and they go into their own sort of narrative of, oh my gosh, I don't want to screw this up for somebody. I so want Allison to get this next job. So instead, I make it much more palatable, and I actually borrow from... just a well-known opportunity, drilling down to something like Facebook and asking people, which there's an author out there named Dori Clark, mm-hmm. and she's very well-known in the world of personal branding. And so she does this three-word exercise. And the three-word exercise is going to your Facebook networks, your LinkedIn networks, your family and friends, and simply asking, what three words come to mind when you think of me?
Wow.
What's different about that than the SWOT analysis is I didn't frame it for anybody. I didn't say, when you think of me in relation to the program or analyst one position, right? So it really opens up all kinds of windows where you might get a lot of attributes that you don't think about if you narrowly focus on a particular skill set. And it can really help somebody identify trends of areas that they might be underutilizing in their career search. Mm-hmm. And it can also be really empowering. You know, we tend to have a very powerful self-critic at our disposals, mm-hmm. particularly when we're wanting something and we're feeling insecure about whether or not we're going to get it.
Absolutely.
So it's so great to go out to the people who know us well and get some affirmations about the things that we do well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always amazing to me with getting feedback from people or in networking situations, how willing and excited people are to help.
There is no question. Not only are they willing and excited, if you present it in such a way that people can say yes, mm-hmm. my experience has been that unless there's some massive time constraint, they will say yes time and time again. I think the human experience is such that people want to help others.
Absolutely. I was just speaking with a client this morning, and we were talking about reaching out to someone for an informational interview. And she said, well, God, I mean, would they even talk to me? And I said, well, would you talk to them? Said, well, of course I'd talk to them. Your inclination is just to help someone, particularly someone who's seeking something of value or wants to learn from your experience. It can be so empowering to talk about yourself, right? And
That's
help
it.
Someone in that way.
Well, empowering too when you get to be an expert. So who mm-hmm. doesn't know about, you know, themselves and their own journey? It's really nice to be able to look back at one's career and be sought after for nothing other than their own life experiences. That's really powerful.
Absolutely. I love your Facebook example because I actually have a close friend and former colleague from when I worked in Boston just did this mm-hmm. on Facebook. And she said, I'm looking for my next career move. What kind of opportunities do you think would be right for me? So not as general. She was a little more focused than your suggestion. But I mean, I sorted through probably 50 comments that people had written, and she responded to each one, and she got so much value from it. We ended up speaking over the phone. A bunch of people had responded, oh, you'd be great working at my organization. Let's hop on the phone next week. I know she talked. Yeah, she talked to someone else who, you know, as we talk about strengths, I love using the Strengths Finder mm-hmm. with my clients. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, have you done Strengths Finder? What are your top five? And when she put her top five strengths there, many other people responded and said, we have similar strengths. These are the jobs that I'm doing. So it's such a wonderful resource. And like you said, I think we think of our network as only being people that have worked with us or we have some kind of formal reporting or colleague relationship. But really, there's so many people that we can easily speak with about what we want to do next or what our strengths are.
And that's it. We often think that we might have to pay for the services of somebody in order to get that information. And yet, in the event that we're on social media, or frankly, if we're not, we're connected to other people who can answer this same question for us. You know, what's interesting that you mentioned about your friend and her Facebook account is the word choice that she used, which is, what kind of jobs do you think might be right for me? Mm-hmm. And I do find that when we're looking for work, we use a lot of shoulding, mm-hmm. and we use a lot of rights, wrongs, and black and white language. So the one thing I'll say about the three-word activity is it removes that filter, this idea that there's a black and a white idea of what I may or may not be doing next. Mm-hmm. And it's really geared towards individuals getting attributes instead of industry. What I love is the idea of maybe following up then, mm-hmm. with, once I have this insight into attributes, then maybe the follow-up being that very activity, which is, now I've learned, as I look at these three words, I seem to be seeing a lot of pattern here. So this is interesting. What do you all think? What kinds of things pop up for you as a result? And see how those two things fit together would be really great.
Absolutely. It's like you have a team of people working for you. So you mentioned it feels like you have to hire someone, but sometimes people are just built in.
That's it.
In your world, oftentimes.
Yeah.
So you use a term called finding your genius work. When I first heard that, gosh, that sounded scary, right? Geniuses are these people that... Albert Einstein type people, and how do we identify our genius work? Do we all have genius work? Tell me about that.
So when I say genius work, I guess I have these catchphrases that I've used over the years. And when I think of genius work, I'm not thinking about Mensa, mm-hmm. and the organization that you have to have a particular IQ to join. When I think of genius work, I think of the name that we give work that exceeds others doing similar work. So this idea that we become a known entity because we're either going above and beyond somewhere, or more importantly, that you're leaving an impression somehow. And it's done either by way of permanent changes you might have made to the scope of a job simply by way of who you are, mm-hmm. or by the creativity and innovation that you might bring into a role that ultimately might inspire other people. So in order to kind of identify someone's genius work, you really need to think about what it is that lights you up and draws others to you. So if you're not sure, this is where that three-word activity can kind of help gain some kind of insight. And the other thing to think about is, what are you naturally good at? Mm-hmm. So genius work is not something that comes with a pedigree and hard years of work gaining degrees or certifications. Genius work is that thing that you can do naturally with one hand and that people are continually seeking you out for.
I love the imagery of what lights you up and what draws people to you, because I think we can all think of those things that get you really excited or that people are always reaching out to you for. One of the questions that I find helpful when I'm thinking about genius work and working with clients on their genius work is looking at, there's two ways, a positive and a negative way to frame this question. So I always start with the positive one and then get to the meat of how people really understand it. But what do you contribute to a team? And the opposite, more negative way to put it is, if you left a team, what would be missing? And people always right away have an answer. You know, I bring the drive, or I'm the person that's always in charge of making sure everyone feels included. I'm the organizer. People always, right at the top of their head, have something. And that's usually the thing that gets them excited. Because when you're in a group, you have the opportunity to kind of see what role everyone will play. And people usually pretty naturally fall into a category, and it's the category that they're good at, where they're really strong.
So true. You know, what's funny is the way that you orient that in asking people what they contribute to a team. I often frame it similarly, and I'll say, if you were to leave for 2 weeks on vacation, what are people sweating over the most? So really thinking about the day that you come back, when people are putting banners up in your cubicle saying, we are so glad you're back. Why? So for some people, you know, and I've often told this story, I worked at Cigna many moons ago, and there was someone in a department adjacent to me who happened to have a love of baking cakes. Mm-hmm. And so on a monthly basis, when it came time to celebrate birthdays, she would make a cake and it would inevitably have some kind of either flavor or color or decoration that reflected a personality kind of nuance in someone on the team. And, you know, it wasn't until she had been laid off that we realized how much that contributed to the morale in the business.
Wow.
So sometimes the things that we contribute aren't part of our job description, and yet they're invaluable, right?
Absolutely.
So I love that. I think that's a great way to figure out what it is your genius work looks like.
Yeah, and that cake was so much more than just a treat in the afternoon when your sugar levels were falling,
no
right?
Question.
It was really brought value to the team and helped you have that morale boost that you need.
That's it. And frankly, you know, I've bridged in my world the individual career counselor role with the organizational need of kind of larger talent development. And this is the piece that's so critical to businesses, is it costs so much more to replace somebody than it does to originally hire and train them. Mm-hmm. So morale is huge. And if you can contribute that and prevent people from leaving their jobs, there's a price tag involved in that that's really attractive to businesses.
Absolutely. Everyone wants to be on a team where people are feeling good and excited to see each other and work together, whether they're best friends or not. As long as there's that good team camaraderie, it makes such a difference in an organization.
No question.
We've all seen both sides of that.
Yes.
I think.
And the flip side's not pretty.
There's a lot to learn, a lot of wonderful things to learn there. So You talked about identifying the things that you're good at and what helps you stand out. And we talked a little bit about how you can find what that is. But recently, I heard you talking a little bit about how that can translate onto your resume. Like, how do you recommend people talk about their genius work on paper in that document that can be, you feel a little dry sometimes?
Sure.
How do you differentiate yourself in that way?
Well, so this is probably where I see this most commonly come into play, is people will default to populating their resume with the job description that came when they got hired, right? So they'll take their key functions and their key duties and responsibilities, and they'll, you know, copy and paste those right into their bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, let's say you have a project manager. So if a project manager is copying and pasting his or her job description in, all a recruiter is seeing that differentiates that person is the name up at the top. And then you run the risk of not only not being recognized for being different, but you run the risk of the very things that are protected by law, that we see natural biases occur.
Mm-hmm.
You run the risk of people making snap judgments about who you are based on gender, based on where your address is, or all the things that you don't want to be considered for when it comes to getting the job. So it becomes really important that your bullet points veer away from a description of the duties of a position, because there's nothing about those duties that describe anything different from the next set of people who train in a similar role, and instead move towards stories of accomplishment. And this can be difficult for people sometimes, for a number of reasons. Culturally, sometimes we're taught that it's not polite to brag.
Right.
Genders are often taught that it's not okay to talk about ourselves without sounding arrogant.
Right.
And so what I recommend that people do is they take a mnemonic that's actually borrowed from the world of interviewing called STAR.
Okay.
And they use a small storytelling project to help populate each of those bullet points. And STAR stands for situation. So what was it that the organization was experiencing? Like, what kind of problem or challenge was it that they were facing?
Mm-hmm.
The T stands for task. And that essentially means who was it who assigned you to do something, and what was it you were asked to do?
Mm-hmm.
And the A, and perhaps this is where people fall flat sometimes, the A is the action. What did you do about it? And this is where you have a real opportunity to make sure that that bullet point is aligned not with a job description of what you've done in the past, but with the job description of where you're headed in the future, because that's where we'll get some guidance as to what kind of pain that organization might currently be experiencing, so that you can make sure that your action is related to the current skills that they're needing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the results. And this one is, I think, where people struggle the most. is moving away from talking about job duties and moving to a place where you talk about what is the outcome been of your work. Mm-hmm. And the one universal language that anyone speaks is numbers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So when you can start defining your work with an impact that uses a number, mm-hmm. whether that number is how much money you've saved or a percent increase in sales as a result of something you've done, or the number of people that you've served, then even someone who's a CFO reading a resume, the emotional connection will come because people relate very similarly to numbers. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, the best way to get genius work into a resume.
That's a great point. And we all talk about how people have piles of resumes and they're scanning resumes. And some people say the 6-minute scan and some people say the 30-second scan. But if we're looking at a document and we're scanning, those numbers pop out so clearly and so quickly. And it's almost like sometimes when I'm scanning a resume before I do a deep dive, as I often do, because I want to treat that resume just like a hiring manager, it's those numbers that catch my eye and then I go back to the words around it.
Yeah, I think not only do they catch your eye, numbers help define scope. So people are constantly reading a resume through a filter of what's in it for me. Mm-hmm. And when your language might not match an environment that you're headed to, numbers are a way for people to relate to something. So for example, if you tell them that you're serving an organization with 1,700 employees, and they have 12,000, mm-hmm. they might think, I'm not certain that this individual is going to be the right fit here. They might sink or swim here.
Right.
And on the flip side of that, if they're in a place of rapid growth and they're a small company, they might have a tremendous amount of relief in knowing that you've been in a larger business and can help grow with them. So it almost provides a red carpet for people to understand how it is that you're going to help them.
That's right. That's right. And I always think, too, when I'm looking at someone's resume, based on a job title, most of us, and you and I are used to looking at a lot of resumes, right. So we're unique cases, but a lot of people could probably guess most of the things that you've done based on what your job title was, right? So people are already making that guess, and you don't probably need to reiterate those tasks. They know what you did because you have a title that's pretty, you know, self-explanatory. But what they want to know is, how did you do it different?
No question. Or the flip side of that is, you know, my current work is not unlike this. I'm in a company that's experienced rapid growth, mm-hmm. and the function is new to the business. So my current title is the Director of Productivity and Performance Improvement. And we've noodled that around multiple times in the business now that I'm doing the scope of the work. Mm-hmm. And different people experience that title differently. So mm-hmm. if you can move away from the title and really get into the meat of what is it that you have done there that's made an impact, mm-hmm. people veer away from titles pretty quickly. And mm-hmm. that's in particular important if you're wanting to get out of the field that you're in. If people have this snap understanding of your title and really think of you as a particular set of skills and you can't make the connection to how you can do something different, then you also run into trouble.
Absolutely. And I think it's human nature to kind of jump to a conclusion, right? We take the shortest route to getting the information that we need. And that's a big reason why, you know, a lot of people hate to put a list of things on their resume that isn't an exhaustive list. And so I did so many things, I can't just name three things, or I need to put et cetera, because I need this list to show that these aren't all the things I did. I did many other things.
Or 10 pages.
Right, right. But once you say et cetera or miscellaneous items, once you put in that cloudy language, it invites the reader to fill in the blanks.
Spot on.
And you only want your voice to be the voice that people hear. So decide what you want to say and then say that, and people will know that it's not an exhaustive list. It is just a teaser, but when you open it up for others to interpret what you might mean, like you said, just by sharing a job title, it's who knows what they will come up with. Maybe it'll be in your favor. Maybe it won't. Maybe it'll be accurate. Maybe it won't.
Well, and the other thing about that is that people get very wedded to the things that cost them the most. Mm-hmm. So I have to put this on my resume because I went home crying every night for 3 months to get this project done. This was the most important thing I ever accomplished. And so my question has always been, and how does it relate to something that your target employer needs today? Mm-hmm. And if someone cannot help me connect those dots, then I will say, check your ego and let's park that. It doesn't take away that experience or all the blood, sweat, and tears. What it does, though, it's a little bit like someone who's run a marathon at the end of that, at that hydration station, they don't want watered down Gatorade. They right. need the full strength. Uh-huh. And that's exactly what it ends up doing, is it dilutes the punch. It dilutes the impact of the most important thing that you've done that relates to the specific need that person has.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point, too, of talking to the job, to the hiring manager's needs. You know, that's why we put a summary at the top of our resume, perhaps, that exactly. talks about what you've done and how you help an organization, as opposed to an objective, right? Because objective is what I want. And, you know, in the most loving way, I always say, but we don't care what you want. Right. We care what you can bring
yes.
to our organization. So it's great that you want a job where you can grow, but I'm thinking, what can you bring to me? So starting that conversation, already speaking their language is so important.
Well, and that's where that summary becomes your best opportunity to articulate what makes you stand out. You know, you talked about the 6 minutes or 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. I've heard it's as few as 17 seconds mm-hmm. that somebody's looking at that resume. However short a period of time, we all know we make snap judgments about people and we have first impressions and you can't go back. Mm-hmm. And there's also, you know, they talk about it in psychology and in neuralistic programming, this idea of haloing. Mm-hmm. So the minute somebody sees a particular word that has an emotional reaction for them, it populates the rest of the whole experience for them mm-hmm. with that same filter. And so we better be really purposeful about the word choices that we use. And if we're not feeling it, then we better use some type of three-word activity with our social networks or somewhere else to help get some positive words in there so that when people populate that belief about us, it's immediately, I want to know more.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You talked a little, so we talked about identifying what your genius work is and how you stand out and then how to put it on your resume. You also have a really unique way, an idea that you give for how people could introduce themselves in a way that helps them show their strengths and their personal brand.
Well, I think that it's really important that when people introduce themselves, our natural tendency is to introduce ourselves with our job title or our affiliation with our employer.
Right.
And frankly, that's not unlike the idea of submitting a resume that has copy and pasted a job description and job duties. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing about it that distinguishes you from anything or anybody else. So I always ask people to think about how to identify themselves without the use of those two things mm-hmm. and to really think about what type of assistance they can bring somebody or what kind of product or service or energy or skill they're most asked for. And I think when you can summarize that in a quick phrase that's authentic, because otherwise, frankly, we'd all sound like used car salesmen.
Right.
But if it's authentic and you can really recognize what it is that you can contribute, people remember that. Mm-hmm. And it helps you stand out from the sea of people that exclusively talk about their title or what I call the zip code, right? Where it is that they do their work. And the danger with affiliations is they're powerful. So what ends up happening if, for example, I recently worked at UCLA for 9 years, and UCLA is a phenomenal place to be in. It's a whole community in and of itself. Mm-hmm. In the event that, for example, I was seeking a position where somebody had gone to USC and had a very strong allegiance to a rival school, for example.
Oh, dear.
Right. So if that powerful response comes up because they're thinking about a football game, then I may have just shot myself in the foot because that might populate the rest of my experiences with that person. So when you remove that title and that zip code, people really get to know the authentic you.
Absolutely. Authenticity is so important in the journey of finding a new role or really talking to people about your best assets. As you mentioned, you don't want to sound like a robot and you don't want to sound like the used car salesman. So I actually interviewed our good friend Tom Henschel mm-hmm. on the show not long ago, and he talked about introducing yourself or answering the tell me about yourself and thinking about getting to the bottom of a ski slope and how you never do it exactly the same way, but you always get to the same place.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
That was really impactful for me too.
Yeah. And I think the important thing there is that is what authenticity looks like. Authenticity looks like if someone zigs, we can zag. Mm-hmm. And authenticity looks like if we're having a rough day, the energy is going to come out a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. That's what makes you trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes you memorable. Because the minute you try and create a persona that's not your true self, people can smell that out from a mile away and it doesn't feel good. And that's the whole essence of branding, is people have the emotional response that says this person has something that is worth repeating and that is going to be valuable to me. And if instead someone's sniff says this doesn't smell like it's a safe place because it doesn't seem consistent,
right,
they're turned off and that's it.
Absolutely. And that comes up so much in interviewing too. You know, if you show up at an interview and you perform, then you're always going to wonder if you didn't get the job, if you should have just been yourself and taken that time before to really identify, you know, what your genius work is, how you can talk about yourself in an authentic way without putting on airs or being something that you're not. And if you get that job as a performance, then, you have to keep performing for God knows how long.
Yes, you do. And frankly, none of us can keep that up.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. So we're talking about differentiating yourself from the competition. How, when people come to you and they're asking, how do I differentiate myself from the competition, how much do you need to know about the competition?
I think that's such a great question. You know, it depends on how wide a focus you have. So if you're looking to become the most known commodity in an entire industry, then you better be doing some market research on a broad scale. Whether it's, you know, looking at the New York Times and seeing who the best sellers are on Amazon, mm-hmm. or whether it's seeing what the top rated podcasts are, you might want to have a sense at that very large level. Mm-hmm. However, if being the best known for you isn't about some kind of likability rating or how many connections you have on LinkedIn, then it really becomes a matter of fine-tuning it for a smaller audience. Mm-hmm. So if you've already identified, for example, a place where you want to work, it could be as small as getting to know who the hiring manager is and what makes that individual tick, and understanding his or her pet peeves, mm-hmm. and how you can avoid triggering any of those so that you can make sure that you've said, hey, I have something here and I can deliver it in such a way that it's going to make your life easier because you're not going to be triggered by the ew factor or whatever mm-hmm. the case mm-hmm. might be. So the thing about job searches is we often tend to think of them as so large mm-hmm. because we're vulnerable or there's an urgency. And so we look for large volumes of input, right? I want to go to every conceivable job search engine and I want to apply. Oh, look, it was a productive day. I submitted 36 resumes, right? So we go for this kind of one size fits all approach. And the kind of counterintuitive part about getting a job is that the best way that you can spend your energy is reflecting inward and thinking about what it is that I want and how does it connect with where it is I want to go. And that's how you can kind of define how big or how small that world needs to be for you.
Absolutely. And with the vulnerability factor, if you don't lay that groundwork, as you mentioned, when somebody offers you a job, you can be in a moment of, I want to be liked. and someone likes me.
Yes.
And it's, you're inclined to take that opportunity. And if you haven't laid that groundwork and you can't go back to what is right for you and where do you want to be, then how can you identify if that's the right opportunity or just an opportunity, and you want to have an opportunity, and gosh, it's nice to be liked? Because that's so often what happens with people, is it's the reactive job search of, I'm going to see a post and react to that post and submit my resume, and then hopefully they like me and want to hire me. But if you come back and do more of a proactive search, where, like you said, you identify a company and then identify the manager to get in front of that manager to, so they're thinking of you the moment an opportunity arises. Gosh, you just put yourself at such an advantage at that point.
And not only just from the application or sort of identification of me as the possibility, when you get into that space of, I want to be liked, I want to be liked, I want to be liked, you lose all your leverage for every kind of negotiation you could possibly have. So beyond simply the scope of the job itself, then you start to look at compensation issues that come up, benefits packages, where people are willing to settle and not really think about what it is that they have that specifically needs, what needs they have that have to be fulfilled in order to make a job have staying power. Mm-hmm. Because if we pick Mr. or Ms. right now in the job, we're often out back on the market within a matter of weeks. And not only is that costly for us, we have the potential of damaging our brand,
right?
Because we're not staying in a job long enough where people really understand our value. And so the lasting impression we make is one of being flaky or non-committal.
Right.
So it's not unlike the dating world, frankly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what I always say, that it's better that in that interview stage and in the dating stage that you realize you're not right for each other, because if you're not right for each other, you'll find out sooner or later.
That's right.
So better to do it early.
Yes.
For sure. Well, we're wrapping up, but I do have one more important question that I'd love to hear your take on.
Sure.
When people are branding themselves and putting their personal brand out there, it seems easy to do if we're making a lateral move or a move within the same industry. How do people best position themselves if they're changing industries? Maybe don't have the experience, but they know they can do it. But how do they translate that?
I think that's such a great question. There's a few things that pop into mind. For starters, again, this is when we often turn inward and get very vulnerable, because we think, do I have what it takes? I really want to do this, and I'm not sure I'm relevant.
Right.
Here's where it becomes helpful, actually, to get outside of ourselves and to start exploring by connecting with people who are already in the fields that we want to do. Mm-hmm. And by asking other people, what kinds of trends are you seeing in your world? What kinds of talent are you looking for? What kinds of needs are emerging? And being very deliberate about making sure you tell those people that you're not actively looking for work from them so much as you're looking for information to guide your search.
Right.
You can start to understand, how do I frame the stories that I've had? Going back to that STAR statement kind of format that I talked about earlier, and making sure that when I talk about an accomplishment, my language helps identify or matches where people are in need. Mm-hmm. So an example I'll give, for example, when I worked at UCLA and I was overseeing a career and leadership development program, there were a lot of people who worked on what we called the campus or administrative side of things, who might want to move into the UCLA medical system and be in the healthcare side.
That's a big change.
It's a really big change, and it's the same employer, and yet it's a really different scope of function when you are working, let's say, in student services, and suddenly you want to be caring for patients.
Right.
And even if someone didn't want to go back and get a degree that allowed them to care for patients, but they wanted to be serving the patient experience, if I would look at a resume and see all kinds of language about students, I would say, you know, your apple over here looks like an orange over there.
Right.
And so as soon as a hiring manager sees a language that pops up, and it's kind of that one of these things is not like the other sort of vibe when they're reading it, they'll tune it out, because they'll believe that you're not qualified, or more importantly, they'll believe you wouldn't understand what they're going through.
Right.
And that's the emotional connection we want to have with a hiring manager, is I get where your pain is, and I'm going to solve it. And so I think if people can seek out the opinions of people in the industry, and you can do this very passively too. If it doesn't feel comfortable to connect over a phone or in person, you can go to groups on LinkedIn And you can see what kinds of things are in people's profiles and what kinds of language they're using.
Right.
And see where you can kind of gently tweak and massage some of your own word choices to sound more similar. That's a great entry point. And the more you can start rehearsing those words on paper or on your keyboard, the better you're able to start speaking them too. And that kind of helps bridge that gap from the me I am today to where I want to head in the future.
Absolutely. That's a great point too, that I always think of for human resources roles in particular. Companies vary greatly on what they call employees.
Yes.
Are they team members? Are they staff members? Are they employees? You know, maybe there's some cutesy name that goes along with the name of the company. If you start to use that language, so you're not saying anything that's different from your experience, but if you're used to calling them staff members, but you know they're called employees at the other place, start to use the word employees, because like you said, it doesn't give that pause or that hiccup. It creates a seamless conversation, and I'm already speaking your language. You already feel like part of the team in the language that you're using.
That's it. We don't ever want to be in a position where we take our own self-doubt and project it onto the resume. Mm-hmm. Because the last thing you want to do is be in a place where you've left the hiring manager with doubt too. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you start using language, whether it's a three-letter acronym or something descriptive, like staff versus personnel, the mm-hmm. sooner you use the one of these things is not like the other choice, the apples to orange, mm-hmm. the sooner a hiring manager thinks, you know, this person might be great, but I don't think they're going to make it here. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't inspire confidence.
Absolutely. Well, gosh, that was a perfect end to our conversation today, Lori. I really, really appreciate you being here with us. It was a pleasure to chat with you, and you provided so much value to the listeners.
Thanks so much for having me. What a great opportunity. Best of luck to all you out there.
Thank you. At the end of the show, I would like to make a few announcements for those of you that are listening live here on Labor Day. Next week, Jennifer has a great guest named Petra Dernan. They'll be talking about millennials in the workplace. So that's Jennifer's show on September 12th. On September 26th, I will be back to co-host with Jennifer to do another mock interview. The last Monday of the month, we've been doing mock interview Mondays. They've been a great success, and I hope that you'll tune in. And finally, for those of you in Los Angeles, I am doing a job search workshop series. So my website is my name. So if you look at the description of the show, it's AllisonGarrido.com. And you'll see on my meetup page on my website that I am doing a 4-part workshop series. It starts with creating a job search strategy. Then we talk about networking, interviews, and career conversations. Those are free workshops for the community, and I would just be thrilled to see you there. So remember to tune in next week to get yourself the job. And thanks again, Lori. Have a great day, everyone.
Take care.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.